Aid workers begin searching for bodies at Gaza's Al-Shifa Hospital, following the Israeli carnage at the medical facility. Also coming up, the top UN court holds the second and final day of hearings on a case brought by Nicaragua against Germany over its support for Israel's war in Gaza. Thanks for joining us. Palestinians are witnessing an endless spiral of death and devastation in Gaza, where U.S.-Israeli genocide is now in its seventh month. Israeli aircraft and artillery fire continued in various parts of the Gaza Strip, targeting homes and gatherings of displaced people and killing over 30 people in the past day. The mayor of Al-Maghazi and several others were killed when the regime hit central Gaza. To the south, horrors are continuing even after Israeli occupation forces left the city of Khan Yunis on Sunday. So far, 84 bodies have been recovered from under the rubble. Palestinian medical sources say the regime has also significantly damaged the city's hospital and equipment. Since the start of the U.S.-Israeli onslaught on October 7, over 33,200 people have been killed in Gaza. Aid workers have begun searching for the bodies from the rubble of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza after 2 weeks of Israeli attacks on the medical complex. According to relief teams associated with the World Health Organization, the hospital was reduced to ashes by airstrikes and shelling. The Gaza Media Office said about 400 Palestinians were killed and hundreds more were detained in and around the medical complex. Many patients died inside the hospital as a result of the Israeli siege on the complex. Israeli forces pulled out of Gaza's largest hospital after an intensive military operation on Monday. They laid siege to the building and carried out attacks under the pretext that Hamas fighters were operating from there. But the resistance movement has repeatedly denied having any of its fighters inside Al-Shifa or other health facilities. Some aid workers tell about the lack of equipment to pile through the rubble of Al-Shifa Hospital, where some recount the horror that they experienced at the medical complex. Let's take a listen.
Once the Israeli army entered within a minute or two, they surrounded the entire area. And after that, they started using the loudspeaker to say, "This is the IDF. The entire area is surrounded and everyone must surrender." Then they started shooting at all the entrances, preventing anyone from moving. I spent 4 days there with my two little daughters, without any food or water. They cried from the hunger, and when they arrested my husband, he had not eaten for 3 days.
The relatives wish to ascertain the fate of their sons, whether they have been killed or missing or have been displaced to the south. The relatives are present to identify their sons and ensure they receive a proper burial. However, we lack the necessary equipment for this task, and time is not on our side. We must complete the job before the bodies decompose.
There are challenges in the Gaza Strip. We don't have forensic doctors or organizations that document the crimes of the Israeli occupation forces. We try to utilize the expertise of the World Health Organization and the UN Humanitarian Office in documenting the crime which occurred inside the Al-Shifa Medical Complex. As you can see and smell, the stench of death is everywhere. We try with the help of the delegation of the UN Humanitarian Office and the delegation of the World Health Organization to dig the mass graves in Al-Shifa complex and to identify the decomposed bodies and the body parts that were crushed by the Israeli occupation forces. We try to identify these bodies and document these crimes which were committed against these civilians.
Our correspondent Mutia Abu Musaba joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Bala. He gave us details about the situation in Gaza, including the southern city of Khan Yunis, where Israeli forces withdrew from several days ago.
Given that the destruction there is massive, we can say that roughly 80% of the residential buildings and facilities were completely or partially destroyed. This reflects that there is hundreds of the Palestinian civilians are still trapped and missing under the rubble of those destroyed houses. And this means that the number of the Palestinian civilians who were killed over that attack will be massive. And as you know, that the civil defense crews, they are searching for those dead bodies, and they are trying to extract those dead bodies, having their basic tools, and they are using their bare hands in order to extract those dead bodies. So this actually complicates the process, and this complicates the extraction of those dead bodies. We can say that what happened in Khan Yunis is unprecedented in terms of the massive destruction and mass slaughter of the people there. And even when it comes to Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza Strip, the destruction that was inflicted in those areas by the Israeli occupation forces is nothing compared to what happened and took place in Khan Yunis City. What happened in Khan Yunis City is horrific, because as you know, that everything was breached by the Israeli occupation forces was targeted and destroyed. This included actually the residential buildings, the infrastructure, the pipelines, and everything. Everything was targeted and destroyed by the Israeli occupation forces.
The International Court of Justice is holding a second of proceedings on a case brought by Nicaragua against Germany over arms exports to Israel. Nicaragua argued on the first day of the hearings on Monday that Germany is facilitating the Israeli genocide in Gaza by providing weapons to the regime. The Nicaraguan ambassador accused German arms industries of making profits from the devastating situation in Gaza. Carlos José Gómez also pointed out to Germany's defunding of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, saying that the move showed Berlin's support for the bloodshed in Gaza. Germany has defended itself in the claim, saying Israel's security is at the core of Berlin's foreign policy. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has hailed Nicaragua for filing the petition against Germany. It called on other countries to follow the example of Nicaragua and South Africa in taking actions against the genocide in Gaza. Turkey says it has imposed trade restrictions on Israel starting Tuesday in response to the regime's ongoing onslaught in the Gaza Strip. In a statement, the Turkish Trade Ministry said the export ban has been imposed on a range of products, including construction materials such as cement, iron, and steel. Added, the decision will remain in place until Israel declares a ceasefire immediately and allows adequate and uninterrupted flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. This as the Turkish government has been facing public criticism over its double standards as Ankara continues its trade with Israel while at the same time condemns attacks on Gaza. Over the past months, major Turkish cities have witnessed a number of protests against Israel's genocidal war on Gaza. Iraqi resistance groups say that they have carried out fresh military operations against five vital Israeli targets, retaliation for the regime's massacre of Palestinians in Gaza. The Islamic resistance in Iraq says the targets include the Ashkelon oil port and Hadzerim air base in the city of Beersheba. The umbrella resistance group also vowed to continue targeting enemy strongholds. In recent months, the Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israeli targets. It has also hit U.S. military bases in Iraq and in neighboring Syria, retaliation for Washington's complicity in the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The Secretary General of the Hezbollah Resistance Movement says that Iran has every right to retaliate the recent Israeli attack on its embassy in Syria.
In the end, the Americans have come to the conclusion that there will be a reaction. Even the Israelis, they have come to this conclusion. They have recognized that there will be, I think the whole world has, that this is a natural right for Iran, and that it's normal for the Islamic Republic to go ahead with such a retaliation. But of course, everyone's waiting what will happen and the repercussions of what will happen.
Who were killed in Gaza. Of course, this is Nasrullah made the comments in a ceremony held in commemoration of Iranian Major General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, who was killed, along with a number of his companions, in Damascus. The Hezbollah chief said that Israel's stupidity in attacking the Iranian embassy made the U.S. president press Israel to stop the onslaught on Gaza. Nasrullah said Israel has achieved nothing on the ground in Gaza in the past 6 months and has no choice but to stop the genocidal war. Nasrullah also cited Israel's deteriorating situation in the world and its isolation due to its aggression against Palestinians. Iran's Prime Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has visited Syria 1 week after the Israeli attack on Iran's embassy in Damascus. He met with President Bashar al-Assad and Syria's foreign minister to discuss the latest developments. Ibrahim Wahdi reports from Damascus.
In a significant visit as part of his regional tour, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian arrived in Damascus this Monday. Amir Abdollahian met with President Bashar al-Assad, who considered the Israeli attack against the Iranian embassy and the regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza a proof of Israel's failure in achieving any military objectives. Amir Abdollahian highlighted that the Israeli regime is facing its worst times due to the Palestinian resistance, which stands ready to continue its battle against Israel's atrocities.
I have discussed with President Bashar al-Assad a series of events, especially the events in Palestine and the crime that Israel committed against the Iranian consulate in Damascus. This terrorist crime was committed with US-made fighter jets and missiles. Therefore, the US is involved. Israel will receive the due response for its aggression against our consulate in Damascus.
Amir Abdollahian and his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad inspected the Iranian consulate struck by the Israeli regime. They later inaugurated the new Iranian consulate in Syria.
The Israeli aggression against the Iranian consulate in Damascus is a violation of international law and all values on which humanity was founded. The Israeli enemy tries to expand the war due to its complete failure in Gaza. Syria firmly supports the resistance in Gaza and all the resistance movements in the region.
The Iranian foreign minister also stressed that Iran will spare no efforts to stop the genocidal war in Gaza, support its resistance, and deliver humanitarian aid. He concluded his visit at Muassa Hospital to check in on the wounded of the Israeli aggression and express his heartfelt thoughts. This visit comes within the context of Iran's diplomatic efforts to stop the Israeli onslaught in Gaza, and also to reaffirm Iran's right of retaliation for the Israeli heinous crime against the Iranian embassy. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Hamas has called on countries across the world to follow the examples of Nicaragua and South Africa in taking action against the Gaza genocide committed by Israel with Western support. In a statement, the Palestinian resistance movement expressed appreciation for a case filed by Nicaragua against Germany at the International Court of Justice. The lawsuit says Berlin is facilitating genocide in Gaza and demands emergency measures to stop it from supplying weapons to Israel. South Africa had also earlier brought a genocide case against Israel at the top UN court. Hamas says Nicaragua, South Africa, and similar countries are refusing to close their eyes to the worst crime of the contemporary era taking place in Gaza. The Palestinian resistance movement also called on the ICJ to stop ignoring Israeli atrocities and to issue firm decisions to end the genocide in Gaza. Journalist and commentator Sondos Al-Assad joined us earlier from Beirut. She believes that only the U.S. is capable of ending the Gaza war.
The only way that will help the Palestinians is in archiving these crimes and these atrocities and ruining the image of the Zionist occupation and the American administration. But we know that such international bodies like the Criminal Investigation Court and others, they are ineffective and impotent because they are directed and moderated by these Western governments. So yes, it's for the part of exposing the Zionist crimes before the international community. It's something significant, but as I have mentioned earlier, I don't think that they will help the Palestinians and stop this genocide because the only and the only one that can stop this genocide is the American administration. But the American administration won't and has no will to stop this aggression and this genocide.
Recent polls in many Western countries show that Israel's atrocities in Gaza have had an unprecedented impact. The French President Emmanuel Macron continues to give unconditional support to Tel Aviv, but the French public opinion has shifted towards Palestine since October 7. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
Highly politicized French polling agencies have rarely dared to make surveys on Palestine, but after 6 months of attempted genocide, a new poll shows public opinion dramatically shifting against Israel. Since October, support for Israel's plan to eliminate Hamas has dropped from 65% to 56%, while condemnation for Israel's war aim has jumped from 35% to 44%. Following the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, France had become an ardently pro-Zionist country. But the polls show that a nation evenly split on support for Palestine isn't far away.
Here in France, we have many stars and actors who are Arabs and Muslims, but who don't say a word about Palestine and who don't support the Palestinian cause openly. It's a shame because they could have a big impact on the French public. Instead, they shut themselves up.
Israel est illégitime.
Israel is illegitimate and has no right to exist. Palestine is unjustly occupied, and I don't see how anyone can fail to see that. I'm waiting for Iran and Hezbollah to do their work, and for Israel to get out.
As Palestinians return to the city of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, the results of 6 months of war are catastrophic. Israel has killed over 33,000 people and wounded 80,000 others in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. Famine is affecting half of Gaza's 2.2 million people, while some two-thirds of the nation's buildings have been reduced to rubble.
This war really has to stop. People are forgetting that the Palestinians are humans, just like everyone else. There are just horrible things going on for women and children, and there has to be peace immediately.
After 6 months, the United Nations Human Rights Council finally took a position on the horrific invasion. They called for a halt in all arms sales to Israel and for Israel to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity. Many attribute the Western public's shift against Israel not to the mainstream media or brave politicians, but to the gruesome and heartbreaking images being relayed on social and alternative media. Images of the human costs of the West's support for Tel Aviv have long been censored. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. The Zionist regime military admits grave mistake in killing of 7 aid workers. Interim results of a 72-hour investigation revealed the aid group had shared information with the military about the convoy. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, the Israeli regime military has said that its troops made a grave mistake in targeting a humanitarian convoy with a series of airstrikes that killed 7 international aid workers recently. The deaths of workers for the World Central Kitchen, which included 3 Britons, an Australian, a Pole, a Palestinian, and a dual U.S.-Canadian citizen, have been widely denounced by governments and organizations around the world. The aid workers were killed in 3 consecutive strikes by the Zionist regime drones on the WCK vehicles, which were delivering 100 tons of food aid to Deir al-Balah warehouse. In response to a preliminary investigation into the attack by the Zionist regime army, the WCK demanded an independent commission to investigate the killings, saying the Israeli regime military cannot credibly probe its own failure. Recently, the interim findings of the investigation revealed that the WCK had correctly alerted the army about its convoy and that the vehicles were clearly branded with the organization's logo, but this information had not been cascaded down the chain of command. Yoav Har-Even, a retired military officer who led the investigation, said that the Zionist regime military drones could not recognize the WCK logos at night and called the strikes a grave mistake and a breach of the army's standard operating procedures. According to Har-Even, Israeli forces mistook one of the WCK staff who was carrying a bag for a gunman. He claimed the forces that conducted the strike did not know they were striking WCK vehicles. They were convinced that they were targeting Hamas operatives in vehicles. WCK CEO Aaron Gore described the apologies from the Zionist regime's military as cold comfort for the victims' families and WCK's global family, adding that the organization's work remains suspended. In a statement in response to the investigation, the WCK said that it was clear that the Zionist regime military had deployed deadly force without regard to its own protocols, chain of command, and rules of engagement. It read, "Without systematic change, there will be more military failures, more apologies, and more grieving families." Recently, U.S. President Joe Biden warned the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that continued U.S. support for Israel was contingent on Israel taking specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers. The attack has wiped out WCK's entire operations team in Gaza, prompting the organization to suspend its operations. Since the start of the Zionist regime's genocide against Palestinians in Gaza, the organization has provided at least 43 million meals to Palestinians in Gaza through aid delivered by land, sea, and air. The World Central Kitchen is a critical organization feeding 500,000 people each day with hot meals, a media spokesperson for the World Food Program in Gaza said, adding, "We can't afford to lose that."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. As the Israeli genocide in Gaza passes 6 months and the Palestinian fatalities of more than 33,200, outrage is increasing around the world. This is especially true in certain Muslim countries and some countries from the global south. Earlier this year, we saw South Africa taking the Israeli regime to the International Court of Justice, and now, beyond the Israeli entity, those which are complicit in its genocide are starting to feel increased pressure. First from civil society in their own countries, and now Nicaragua has taken Germany to the International Court of Justice for facilitating the Israeli genocide by supplying the regime with military equipment. Does this represent another change in the narrative against the Israeli regime and its partners in crime, the Western hegemonic front? Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Manchester, Jahangir Mohammed, Director of Center for Muslim Affairs. And Glenn Dyson, Professor of Political Science, University of Southeastern Norway, out of Oslo. Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Manchester and Jahangir. I mean, your overall thoughts about the significance of this move by Nicaragua.
Well, I think it's important. What we see is that countries from what are traditionally called the developing world are increasingly taking a stand against oppression and injustice linked to Western support for the State of Israel. Who would have thought that Germany, a leading Western power, would be brought before the ICJ by Nicaragua. Right. So I think it's significant, but I think, you know, it's not just Germany here that's on trial or Israel at the ICJ. I think what's really on trial is the whole basis of the Western moral and international order that mm-hmm. have always told us it's the rules-based order, everybody must follow it. So I think this is a test in which either the Western rules-based order, moral order will collapse, or there might be some realignment or a revival of it coming from the global south. But we've yet to see that.
Mm. Yeah, well, definitely interesting times to see, as you said, Nicaragua taking Germany to court. And what about that, Glenn? I mean, have we transitioned from a time when countries feared even criticizing the Israeli regime because of the repercussions they would have to deal with from the United States for standing up against the regime's atrocities? How do you see it?
Well, I agree. I think this conflict has to be seen in the wider context in the world, which is the international distribution of power is shifting very quickly from the West more towards the East. And with this, we see indeed the entire framing of the world order being challenged, because keep in mind that after the Cold War, the West under U.S. leadership began to establish what they call the rules-based international order, which is a rival to international law, because under this so-called rules-based order, the U.S. and its allies has the prerogative to violate sovereignty, that is to invade, interfere in domestic affairs, change borders if necessary, all in the service of liberal ideals, so human rights and democracy, allegedly. So this was a hegemonic order, but now we see that the key, not only is the power shifting, but the key legitimacy of this whole order, the idea that the West was somehow acting altruistically in the benefit of humanity, is now being very openly challenged. And we see this in Gaza, this Germany, which is supposed to be a new moral power, having learned from history, is now being accused of essentially assisting genocide. And it's not an unreasonable accusation either, because the ICJ did argue that this was a likely case of genocide and called for protecting the Palestinians. And instead, the Germans have been supplying more weapons. So this could make Germany complicit in genocide. Now, obviously, the trial is still ongoing, but this, I think, reflects both the power shifting away from the West, but also the legitimacy for how the West would use this power in the international system. So okay. It's very significant.
Okay, well, Jahangir, how likely is it that these countries, which are complicit in this genocide, will answer for their crimes against, given the fact that the ICJ has no mechanism to enforce its rulings?
Well, I think that's the test. You know, we know that the West and Israel have been above all international laws. There doesn't seem to be a mechanism, and the ICC, which has some power, hasn't even started to investigate what's happened in Gaza. So, you know, I'm not hopeful myself. I think the international order will collapse, and that people won't be held to account. And what will happen then is there will be a loss of trust, and I think, you know, the Muslim world or people in the global south will start to set up their own mechanisms to try people and bring countries to account. We might see, you know, different types of order emerging or competing orders emerging. You know, these rules and laws were not really meant for the global south and the sort of non-European countries. They were meant for the hegemony of the West and the European order that's ruled the world for about 500 years and for their interests. So we shouldn't hold any great hope, but then let's see if the international order can adjust, can bring people to account. And I think the hope lies in civil society, really, within Western countries, which is taking a different direction to the governments. You see lots of civil society actors, groups, demanding justice because they can see the grave injustice that's taking place. Mm-hmm. And that may force a shift in the power balance. We're yet to see.
Well, Glenn, 30% of Israel's arms come from Germany and 69% of its arms come from the United States. And this has continued during this genocide. I mean, your thoughts, I mean, what does this mean?
Well, it simply means that this whole pretense that, human rights were effectively a core principle, it's severely weakened, because everyone now, even if they don't are recognize it as a genocide, they recognize that this is a massacre, an extreme violation of human rights, and they're still sending weapons. Now, if something is a principle, one would support, you know, human rights irrespective of where it is. So we see that the principle itself is abandoned, and this is, again, by the United States and Germany. So I guess, you know, the U.S. has more dirty shirts in its hamper, of course, but I think more have been surprised by the actions of the Germans, who seem to suggest that because of their previous role in history with genocide during the Holocaust, that they have a special obligation to to be supportive of Israel by essentially
and that
now
is
supporting
quite, isn't
a genocide
that quite complex?
So,
that is very complex, and for a lot of people, I mean, when we look at, sorry to interrupt you, Glenn, but you mentioned with the, it's this German guilt, of course, that the Palestinian people had nothing to do with, that they continue now to support another genocide. And also you said that a lot of countries, they still won't say that the word genocide. I'm going to ask you a question, what actually the Syrian foreign minister today, Faisal Mehrdad, said, if this isn't genocide, then what is genocide?
Yeah, no, well, this is my point as well, that I think that this strong impulse to excuse everything when it effectively is done by what we would then consider to be one of our own, which is considered to be Israel, one of our own, the part of the West, then obviously the first impulse is always to excuse this. And but now the severity of the war crimes and genocide being committed, it makes this impulse to excuse so much more dramatic. And it's to some extent reminiscent of the 19th century. At this point, at this time, there was also the British pushing their idea of a liberal empire, and they very clearly differentiated what happened in the civilized world, which was the West, which they called the garden, and the rest of the world, which was the jungle. The main argument was, when you're out in the jungle, this, the same rules don't apply. Now, this seems like an effort almost to revive this mentality. Indeed, the language has often been used along these lines as well. But this is a very different world. Not just the global South won't put up with it, but even within the West, as mentioned, civil society. You know, the West is not uniform. Among the public, there is a huge uproar, even in places like the United States, where they quite getting quite used to having continuous war. There's also a huge uproar against you know, the horrific human rights abuses taking place in Gaza. So there is tensions within the West, mm-hmm. where the geopolitics is in conflict with the morality of this.
Yeah, well, John Geer, would you say that the Western hegemonic front in general has basically discredited themselves and have no right really ever to talk about human rights nor international law? Are we seeing more and more of a realization that we have heard these phrases for forever, but the reality is something else?
Yes, I think, look, I think as far as the political orders in the West were concerned, human rights was a kind of a civilizing mission, a tool to enforce their imperialism and hegemony, which, you know, in the past, the Bible was used when they went to Africa, and notions of racial supremacy. Today, human rights is used has been used as a stick to beat other countries, particularly in the developing world. And there's been a massive shift even amongst the ordinary people here. You know, I speak to the Muslim community and Muslims who are in the Labour Party who've left who are now voting for independence. And the most common phrase that I hear is, we don't ever want to be lectured by the West on human rights ever again. You know, it's amazing how common that sentiment is these days. So I think it's collapsing before their very eyes. Nobody's going to take the West seriously on morality, on women's rights, and on human rights anymore. When you see women and children slaughtered in Gaza, you know, everybody can see it's a genocide when all means of livelihood have been destroyed for a people, and you're not moved by either humanity or any notion of human rights or even international law. That's just a total collapse of your values that you claim to champion.
Well, let's look a little bit closer, Glenn, at these last 6 months, because despite the unbelievable support that the Israeli regime has received from its backers, it has accomplished nothing from a military perspective in Gaza during this time. Your thoughts on that, and what exactly has happened? Because its stated goals, one was to destroy Hamas, and of course the other was to return the captives, that has not happened. your thoughts of what has happened here from the military perspective.
Well, this is this bears similarities to the Americans' so-called global war on terror. The problem is that what they define as terror is a way of fighting. It's not as a means to an end. It's not a defined enemy. And I think that there's a similar problem with Hamas. It's an idea. It's considered by many to be a resistance movement. So if you're trying to fight Hamas by massacring a civilian population, all they're doing is then fueling support for the resistance. So, you know, for every Hamas fighter that actually fought, they're not going to change much on the ground, which is why this is a very futile attempt. And it's also a great shame. I would say it was a great tragedy for Israel, because it's delegitimizing itself as a state and is fighting a conflict which will only end up putting itself in a much, much worse place. If I could just have a quick comment by what the former guest just said, I just want to say I agree that this is a much, much wider conflict in terms of collapse of legitimacy of because if you see how the context when this has happened, this is the same time as the U.S. is putting all this I would call it illegitimate economic sanctions on the Chinese. They seized all the central bank funds they could of Russia, something never been done. They hijacked the oil tankers of Iran. You know, they don't even want to sit down and talk to Russia, even after 2 years of war fighting in Ukraine. Diplomacy has been banned. And now you effectively have this war in Gaza, where they keep sending in weapons, even though the ICJ has warned that this is likely a genocide. So it's across the board, you see hegemony collapsing, and not just in power, but in the legitimacy, effectively how what made the legitimacy which had the hegemony rested upon. So you can't really overstate how dramatic what huge consequences this conflict will actually have.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jahangir, the Israeli regime's ace of space has always been propaganda and showing itself stronger than it is and trying to intimidate its enemies. However, the regime no longer has that semblance of invincibility, which it tries to portray to the world. Tell me your thoughts on the importance of this development.
I think it's truly significant because, you know, for 75 years, Israel has maintained this whole idea of its supremacy, not just in terms of racial dominance, but also as a civilizing force, the Judeo-Christian Western values, and that it was some kind of wonderful liberal project, which was a part of Europe in the Middle East, and that, you know, Israel were the good guys, and the ideology was a nationalist ideology which was acceptable. I think that's totally fallen away. I mean, people would not criticize Israel or be afraid to criticize Israel. That's just today, whenever you see somebody supporting Israel, just watch the counter comments on social media. And social media, plus the live streaming of the genocide that we've seen, has changed that totally, because ultimately human beings are all capable of recognizing injustice and oppression and something that is wrong. And that, you know, people have self-educated themselves on the whole history of Palestine just by social media. You know, the whole idea of a colonial settler project, young people on social media, wider society in the West as well. Whenever their politicians say something, there's always an answer. Whenever somebody makes a historical claim, somebody comes up with a research into history and counters it. So it's the only thing is that in Western governments, that hasn't shifted yet. So we have a bizarre situation in Britain, for example, where we can't criticize Israel, a foreign state, but we can criticize our own government and its policies openly.
Right. Yeah, similar, I think, also in the United States. Well, Glenn, do you think that one of the reasons the regime has been so brutal, especially during the last 6 months, is that it does not want to lose the deterrence of inflicting fear, and it wants to commit crimes so horrible that the Palestinians would not dare to resist? Your thoughts about that, and if you agree, has the regime been successful with that tactic?
Well, I think there's always been a strategy for Israel, that is to be able to display this overwhelming power. Now, this, of course, is a dilemma. On one hand, if you are overly aggressive and dominate in this way, you're also interpreted as being aggressive. So this, you know, this is a choice. But Israel has favored, overwhelming power. So it would have a proper deterrent effect on anyone who would want to challenge it or threaten it. But here we see now Israel unleashing all this great power and demolishing, you know, Gaza, and this is supposed to have a huge deterrent effect, but you see instead there's continuing fighting back in the area, and it's effectively not working. So I think they're ending up with the worst case now, which is that they already used overwhelming power, mm-hmm. but they're seen as aggressive, but without being able to deter. So there is a huge shift going on. And I would also say, I would agree, I think there's a new generation, especially in the West, coming up now with a different mentality, because at least the former generations, including mine, who, you know, grew up in the 70s, for us, there have was always collective guilt because of the horrific crimes committed against the Jewish people, but during the Holocaust. But now you see a new generation who don't necessarily think that this should be, give a green light for Israel to do anything it wants, and right. That's probably a much healthier attitude to have. So there is a huge shift, I think, in the mentality of the entire population.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Social media.
Well, Jahangir, your take on their current truce talks going on in Egypt. How do you see that playing itself out? Do you think that they can be successful, and what would it take in order for truce talks to be successful?
Well, I think we're hearing different things. At the same time, arms are being supplied by countries to Israel. I think at the moment, Israeli society and their government are worried about an Iranian strike, and they're shifting their resources for that reason. But it's difficult to see a ceasefire when Israel has made its goal clear in terms of the total destruction. They had hoped that the Palestinian people would have moved or left. And they haven't. They've been resilient. I mean, this is really a test between faith on the one hand and power, ultimate power, on the other. Doesn't seem to be working. The hostages have not been released. Hamas still seems to be able to fire rockets and kill Israeli soldiers. So there does appear to be confusion in Israel as well, with the protests, and the West on the one hand is totally committed to the settler colonial project of Israel, but they've got elections in both the UK and the US, and their own populations are becoming increasingly angry, and politics has started to change as well.
Well, Glenn, with growing pressure from various countries and division inside of the Zionist entity itself, do you think the regime totally miscalculated its genocide on Gaza? And do you see the regime exploding from outside pressure or imploding from the inside?
Well, I'll be careful to make predictions, but obviously there's both pressure inside and outside. The inside, you have to keep in mind that if they would agree to a ceasefire now, or even pull out completely of Gaza, many would see this as a defeat in Israel. And obviously for Netanyahu, it will be a huge defeat. But at the same time, they have to be careful not to exhaust themselves, and they also have to deal with the possibility of now the conflict spreading in terms of them pursuing a conflict with Lebanon, with Hezbollah, or potentially even with the conflict with Iran could also escalate, as evident by, you know, Israel striking the Iranian embassy. So this can very quickly get out of hand. But it's not, as I just pointed out as well, it's not just this internal dimension in Israel where there's a lot of tensions. It's also from abroad. And I think the elections, especially in the United States, puts a lot of pressure because this is a very, very unpopular war. And Biden's own electorate are majority now for ending this war. So
okay.
I think there will be more pressure possibly coming even from the Americans, who have so far allowed Israel to do whatever they want.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on the program. Jahangir Mohammed, Director of Center for Muslim Affairs out of Manchester, and Glenn Diesen, Professor of Political Science, University of Southeastern Norway out of Oslo. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters. 9,650 kHz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Rouhani is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, at the end of the holy month of Ramadan, there is a famous celebration which is celebrated by all Muslims around the world called Eid al-Fitr. So we know that the holy month of Ramadan, according to Islamic beliefs, is full of blessings and full of the rahmah and barakah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So now the main question is, why the people with finishing this month, they celebrate? Usually celebration is for an happy occasion. Are they happy with the finishing of the holy month of Ramadan, or what is the matter?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, Eid, the term or the word Eid in Arabic is rooted in the word Aoud, which means return. Mm-hmm. This is the general meaning of the term Eid in the Arabic language. So now by Aoud or returning, what we mean is that since in this holy month of Ramadan, the people who fast, they purify their souls from the wrong, deeds, from the sins. And then at the end of this, holy month of Ramadan, it seems that they return back to Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
Because these good deeds, these prayers, these ibadat and worships, they help them to purify themselves. Since we are originally pure, whenever we turn back to this original purity, that is called Eid, that is called Aoud or returning. So now if a person purified himself or herself in this holy month of Ramadan, at the end of this month, it means that he returned or he turned back to Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So that's why he must be happy. He is happy.
Yes.
He must be grateful and thankful to Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that, oh Allah, you provided me with this chance to fast in this holy month of Ramadan, to purify myself, to not to commit sins, for example, in this holy month. So this was a kind of process of cleanliness and purification for me. So that's why my soul is now pure and clean. I turned back to that original soul, which was pure and clean. I am really happy. I am really, enjoying this kind of opportunity now and this kind of Eid that I have. So that's why whenever, whatever day that you can turn back to Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that's the Eid.
That's right.
That is the Eid.
Okay.
This is the general meaning of Eid. That's why we should be happy, and we are happy that we could purify ourselves.
Yes. That's right. And usually when the holy month of Ramadan is finished, the people might lose track, the main track of the holy month of Ramadan when they enter the month of Shawwal. But it is very much recommended in Islam to keep the spirit of fasting and Ramadan during the upcoming months after the holy month of Ramadan too, isn't it?
Yes, of course, as you rightly mentioned, it doesn't mean that only in the holy month of Ramadan we should be careful about ourselves or deeds. No, it means that once you purified yourself, so you have to continue, you have to be continuously pure and clean from any kind of sins and wrong deeds in the rest of the months. That's why it's a kind of journey that starts with the holy month of Ramadan, and it should continue till the next month of Ramadan. In the next month of Ramadan, we must be again careful and mindful about all the deeds that we do every day, every moment. Yeah, that is why this is the reason that we should be thankful and grateful to Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And at the same time, we should ask always Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that, oh Allah, please help me to be in Eid every day. Which means that to be always returning to you, Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, every moment of my life. There is a very, very beautiful poem from one of the Persian poets, Sana'i Ghaznavi.
Yes.
Says that, عارفان هر نفس دعید کنند عن کبوتان مگس قدید کنند. That's a very beautiful poem. Says that عارف, the one who has true ma'rifah of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he has two Eids every moment of his life, because the according to this Urafa, each one of these breathing that we breathe is a kind of Eid. That's why, because it provides us with a new opportunity, a new, let's say, golden chance to live more, because by this living more and more, we would have more opportunities to attain more proximity to Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, more proximity to the perfection.
Yes.
That's why every moment is like Eid. Mm-hmm. Not only one Eid, two Eids.
Yes.
Yeah, this is the point that are mentioned also in the Quran and Riwayat, that Eid is a kind of returning to your original purity, which is from Almighty.